Hi, I'm Astrid, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. Thank you, Mark, and thank you the whole group for asking me to come share my experience, strength, and hope. And thank you, Christine, for road dogging it with me and doing the 10-minute thingamajig. It's good. It was very good and very clear, and I got something out of it. And I hope I can help somebody tonight here. I really, really do. You know, carrying the message is a big part of this program, and we keep what we have by giving it away. And it's also, it's a self-diagnosing disease, you know. The book says that I'm the only one that can concede to my innermost self that I'm truly an alcoholic. And then we talk about just the levels of denial or strange mental blank spots or I'm a giant, yeah. Or, you know, self can't see self. Self is designed not to see itself. Or the disease speaks to me with great authority. And so, you know, for me, I definitely throw in childhood trauma in there because I do believe a lot of people here came from childhood trauma. And if you come from a household and a family where there's a lot of restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness, you're going to make a restless, irritable, and discontented child. And one of the number one symptoms of childhood trauma is insomnia or also not sitting still. I'm 65 years old, so definitely nobody diagnosed anybody with ADD and ADHD or even said this child has got untreated alcoholism, but I'm telling you, I'm headed for trouble, and you can tell. And they'd say, you know, she's got the attention span of a hummingbird, or she can't sit still, or she's a fidget midget, or she's always in trouble. And this isn't to blame my parents, but it's to show you that my ecosystem in the beginning, there was so much chaos that I was in continuous fight or flight, and I had no ability to self-soothe. The alcoholic has no ability to self-soothe. That is why alcohol becomes a solution for so long for us. They haven't found the gene for alcoholism. They haven't found the part in your brain for alcoholism. I don't believe they ever will. I do believe that we cross over the invisible line in various stages. Some people say, I was an alcoholic the minute I had a first drink. I was not an alcoholic the minute I had a first drink. I loved partying for a while. And I remember being in like junior high and high school, and I would want to go to school during the week. We partied on the weekend. Where's the party? Friday night, Saturday night. I got a hangover on Sunday. I want to go to school on Monday. Those were my thoughts. I didn't have the phenomenon of craving when I woke up and I was in 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade. Didn't have it yet. Didn't cross over the invisible line yet. But I can see as I look back, something happened to me that was different for me that was not happening to my fellows. I can see that, you know, in California, 2 o'clock and the liquor store closes down or 7-Eleven stops, you know, stops selling alcohol. And it's like, yo, you know what? Last call or the store's going to close in 30 minutes. Pass the hat. Who's going to get the liquor? And I swear to God, it was always me pushing for that last. And I can remember, like, you know, girlfriends and friends going, you know, slow down, Turbo. What the fuck's wrong with you? You really got to do this. You really got to go till the wheels fall off. And I can see that I didn't necessarily even drink like my friends. I turned into a blackout drinker. And, you know, the book says I'm a true Dr. Jekyll and Mrs. Hyde. Truly, like, I have a huge personality shift when I pour alcohol in me. And that personality shift gets worse as the disease progresses. So maybe in the beginning, I don't sleep with strangers. Maybe in the beginning, I don't just do or say whatever. Maybe in the beginning, I don't have fair-weathered friends. Maybe in the beginning, I'm still able to keep up my grades or hold a job or suit up and show up. But if you be a real alcoholic, the day is going to come where not only do we cross over an invisible line, but you know what? Life as we thought it or as we saw it or as we desired it, we're not going to be able to follow through. The alcoholic classically means well, and I can't do well. I'm a loser, I'm a failure, whatever you want to call it. And alcohol creates that. It's not that I don't have self-discipline. It's not that. It's that as I'm growing and as I'm developing as a young person, the alcohol itself and my alcoholism and active addiction stunts my emotional growth. It stunts me in developing healthy self-esteem, healthy self-awareness. Even being able to be in a relationship where I don't have to argue with somebody all the time, where I can allow you to have your say, and I actually sit still and listen without getting ready for Freddie and creating some kind of dialogue in my head of what I'm fucking going to tell you after you're fucking finished with your sentence. And I allow you to process, and we process. And I know how to own my part or see my part or say I'm sorry. And those types of tools most of us don't have. And so if I look back at my own track record, I don't really need to diagnose or take your inventory because mine is a nightmare. You know, I love this. They say, your picker's broken. It's so much bigger than your picker's broken. I'm telling you right now. Broken picker. I was like right here. It is so big. You know, this isn't also to blame my dad. My dad was a college professor. He got his bachelor's at Harvard, his master's at Columbia, and his PhD at Princeton, but he beat his daughters. You want to make a good alcoholic, knock the shit out of your kids all the time. Just knock the shit right out of them. Just smack them and hit them, kick them, call them names. It's on and cracking because that self-esteem and that feeling loved and that being heard is a very big part of what's wrong with us. Again, this is not to blame anybody, but I can see that I'm fragile inside, that I'm thin-skinned, and I don't have the awareness. Maybe my eye contact is really bad. Maybe I don't know how to make friends. You know, maybe I don't know how to just back down. So as time goes on, you know, a guy walks into the room or into a party and he's already got restraining orders and I'm in love. I'm just in love. Like literally, if you look at the frequency you vibrate at, and it's shown over and over in kinesiology, that absolutely, 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 I'm attracted to what I'm vibrating at. There really, truly is a vibrational frequency. Now, they're able to tell us so much more. The heart mind goes out in about a 40-foot radius and then comes back again. Just like the energy of the sun. The energy of the sun pushes its energy out and it draws it back in. Which, that's the reason why I'm at a party or wherever, you know, at a meeting and somebody walks in a room all the way across the room and I already like you or I hate you. Before I've even met you, I feel something. I get a bad vibe. I get a good vibe. I get a crazy life. I love crazy. You've been in prison a couple of times. Baby, let's go. It's on, you know. I don't know why. I just, like a Wall Street guy in a three-piece suit that wants to pull my chair out and open the door for me. I literally think you're a fucking idiot. You're a clown. What's the matter with you? It's terrible. It's really, truly, truly sad. And most alcoholic men are not gentlemen. And most alcoholic women are not ladies. And I'm not here to be Miss Manners. You know, I actually don't love having to go to a meeting where they ask me to wear a dress because homie don't wear dresses. I mean, I'll dress nicely, but I think that's going a little bit too far. And I do feel that, somebody thinks that's really funny, but I do feel that I don't know how to act. That again, I mean well, but I can't do well. So alcohol starts to do for me what I can't do for myself. And alcohol eventually becomes my master. And I go to a party, somebody hands me a Budweiser, I open that Budweiser, and boom, I have an attention span. I can look you in the eye. I'm actually interested in what you have to say. I'm not interrupting. Something's happening. I like this. People say liquid courage, you know, I feel good. People still to this day, people that aren't really alcoholics, they'll say things like, oh, I have to get a drink or two in me and then it's more fun, you know. Even non-alcoholics don't like going to a date or a party without having a drink or two. And unfortunately, that's what we have to learn how to do here is literally live life on life's terms or more importantly, on God's terms. And that's way far, way down the road. I am a retread. I've gone round and round and round. I have a personal opinion about the way AA treats relapsers, and I don't necessarily like it. I think the doors should be swung wide open, and I'll tell you all about that later. But if you be a real alcoholic, there's very few people that walked in here their first fucking meeting. I got it, and a big book, and a sponsor, and I'm just in my four-step, and I love that fucking inventory. I'm just looking at what my part is in, and I love those columns. I can't wait for step 8 and step 9. I'm going to let everybody know and I'm just going to fly like an eagle. I don't think so. You know, so often statistically, people relapse in the middle of a fourth step. I believe maybe part of why they relapse in the middle of a fourth step is because the foundation of steps 1, 2, and 3 weren't laid. Now, mind you, they asked me to share, so I get to share my opinion, my experience, strength, and hope. There's so many ways to go through the steps. Some sponsors want you to just hurry through everything as fast as you can. My grand sponsor, Bob Anderson, and my home group, I'm not the be-all, end-all. You know, I don't clean up Clancy's dog shit. I don't know any of that stuff. You know, I've just had people that have laid down a lineage for me, and that's what I follow. You know what? It's people that I respect, that they have something that I want. It's not their name, and it's not how many digits of sobriety that they have. That's not an attraction to me. What's an attraction is somebody that can break down, you know, back down. Somebody that's got a relationship with God. Somebody that wants to own their own stuff. Somebody that's cleaned up their life and really had a true internal character change, like the book talks about. So I come into AA and, you know, I cross over an invisible line and I'm crazy as a loon and I don't get it the first time. I don't know who gets it the first time. I hardly ever like ask a hand raising, but I'm just going to, for the fun of it once. Who in this room got it the very first time? 1, 2, 4, 4, 5, 6. Nice. 6 out of 150. Cool. Okay. If that was cancer, we'd all be dead. Okay. Yeah. I mean, but it's very rare. That is rare. That is rare. We are retreads. You know, so anyway, I drank and I drank and I drank until the wheels fell off, you know, went to, you know, just fair-weathered friends, crazy bars, bad things happened to me. By the way, if you're a depressive, which most alcoholics are, alcohol is a depressive. Alcohol is a classic depressive, which means that every morning I wake up and I have such a bad hangover that I want to kill myself. I'm a suicidal maniac. I don't like my life anymore. I want out, out, out. I might even swear to God I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink tonight. And then what happens? Somewhere around 5 o'clock, I change my mind. I don't change my mind. The disease changes my mind for me. Because my self-will isn't strong enough. There's only one thing stronger than self-will, and that's God. That liquor is so much stronger. This disease is so much stronger than self-will. It's so much stronger than my instinct as a mother to nurture my child. It's so much stronger than right from wrong, don't steal. I'm not a thief until maybe you get me good and drunk and then crazy things happen. When we're under the influence or we're deep in our disease, our moral fiber can go right out the window. I don't know, maybe you got somebody buried in your backyard. Maybe you've robbed somebody. Maybe you've raped somebody. Maybe you've had guns blazing in a ski mask and they're still looking for you. I don't know. I forgive you. You know, I got enough of my own history. This disease is no joke and it really needs a lot of help and a lot of treatment. And the beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we come in here and we can just be the biggest loser and people love us and people help us. And it's a place where we can really begin to learn how to get well. First time I got sober, I stayed sober for 10 years. I had a child. I bought a house. I put myself through college. And as I had a child, I was so sure that I was done with alcohol because now I'm a mother. Well, that's a funny thought. Man, I'll tell you, my daughter's 35 right now. She's in therapy and she can't get pregnant. She's trying to have a child. And she's really rummaging around in the past, which I don't mind. I'm so glad. Go for it, you know. Go for it and throw a mirror in my face. And she has abandonment issues, you know, and she sees that the road was rocky and sometimes I was there and sometimes I wasn't. And then I lived in the street for 3 years and she was raised by other people. And for the first time in her life, she's even using words like foster care, and I'm staying in my lane. I'm just allowing her to process. But the damage that we do to others, and we often don't see it, we leave people in our wake in a nightmare. And then, like the big book says, that guy comes out of that whatever, that cellar, and the whole yard's all torn up. He's like, "What, Mom, what the heck's the matter? I don't see nothing." And her whole house is ripped apart, and all her fruit trees are upside down, and the car's on its side. And he's like, "Mom," just scratching his head. You know, because self can't reveal self to self. The disease is designed not to see itself. The disease is designed not to see itself because our ego has to protect us. Because most of us come from hell. And if you came from two lovely parents that said grace every night and Mom put you to bed and laid next to you and read you a story and birthdays and Christmases were beautiful and they showed up to every baseball game and all of that stuff, yay. Yay for you. That wasn't for me and that wasn't for most of us. We know so much more psychiatrically. You know, they say that the average child, if they have 3 or more severe childhood traumas, the chances of having post-traumatic stress or of being an alcoholic just go through the roof. Not everybody that has post-traumatic stress is necessarily an alcoholic. Some people that have post-traumatic stress from childhood, they don't even know they have it, but they're an A-type personality. They have to control their environment. Every hair, every shoe, everything needs to be straight, straightened out. Look, that's crooked. This is literal. Hey, what the heck? They have literal control over their environment. It's the only thing that's going to make them feel safe. They don't feel safe. Then there might be the overeater down there in the basement, you know. I was 200 pounds by the time I was in second grade. Oh, hell no, that wasn't us, you know. We were lighting matches and telling our parents to fuck off, you know. We were stealing liquor by the time we were in sixth grade, you know. We found weed and joints and stuff and pills, and we're like, hey, and we're poisoning our classmates, you know. The teacher's getting mad. Everybody's getting mad. We are the wild one in the neighborhood. The wild, I'm the ringleader for frickin' Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey, my own circus. And that can go on. It can go on forever. That's how I get attention. I get negative attention. And that's what I thrive on, because I don't know how to be in this world. I mean well, but I can't do well. I can't do the right thing. So as time goes on, if you be a real alcoholic, the wheels are going to start to fall off. And what used to be a solution now turns into a big problem. You know, you start getting in fights with your boyfriend, with your girlfriend. Everybody wants to say, especially men, I never hit a girl. Let me tell you, if you date me, I'll be sure you have hit a girl by the time you're married. All right? So hold on, Turbo. And even that stuff, I just forgive you. I really do. I really forgive you. I forgive you for throwing all her stuff out on the lawn and lighting it on fire, for fucking her sister. I've heard it all. I'm in AA. I've heard it all. I have heard anything. And you cannot shock me. You cannot shock me. You just cannot shock me. You can't. This guy's leaving. He can't stand this story. Anyway, hey. Anyway, if you be a real alcoholic, anything's possible. And we hang out with fair-weathered friends, and everything goes from bad to worse. So the first time I get sober, I don't even have a God in my life. I stay sober for 10 years. I got a child. I got a house. I've got a business. But I don't have a prayer life, or I don't have a brake pedal, or I don't have, in the literature they say, to turn it over, or there's one that has all power, that one is God, or any life run on self can hardly be a success, or we must be rid of the self or it kills us, or God, I offer myself to thee, build with me, do with me as thou, relieve me of the bondage of self, you know. And so what is this self? What is it, you know, what is a self-imposed crisis? What is the self thing? For me, if that's not broken down properly, I don't know what I'm doing in step 4. It's just an opinion. Do whatever you want. They say the 5th edition is now going to have a freaking chapter on sponsorship. I really hope not. Come on, central office. Don't fuck with us like that. I just don't think things have to be that perfect. Come on. It's an organic disease with an organic solution, and God's infinite. So hold on, you know. Anyway, I start to see myself and my behavior, and I'm all over the place, and I'm losing control, and I don't know what self is. I don't know how self operates. You know, I think even in the United States, and maybe even in other countries, for some reason, we're not really taught to look at ourselves. You know, it's that kind of thing like, you know, you should look at your, what is wrong? Is something wrong? Somebody need discipline over there? What the hell's going on? We're undisciplined, so we let the person at the podium discipline us. Just kidding. So anyway, where was I? I was somewhere in, I don't know what's wrong with me, and I can't see myself. Self can't see self to self. Cannot. Just cannot. So we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate, sometimes seemingly without provocation, you know? And I get what I always get. Fair-weathered friends, they hate me. Oh, that's used to be a friend. Now it's a frenemy. You know, I break up with people. I move around. I do geographics. I quit that job. I quit that relationship. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, thank you, God, we learn how to self-reflect. We really take true stock, true inventory. We really look at the problem and how we did this. And we look at how self behaves. Even if we were treated really poorly, even if we were the product of incest, even if we were the product of neglect, even if we were the product of severe physical beating, etc. Now, there's one glitch or sort of mistake. I don't want to call it a mistake. There's one little area in Alcoholics Anonymous where I really like to talk about just for a minute or two. Psychiatric community now has realized that if somebody's been severely neglected or abused or raped or beaten or whatever, to ever make this victim go apologize to a perpetrator and say, hey, Uncle Joe, I'm sorry I hated you for so many years after you impregnated me three times, or whatever the hell sponsors do. Sometimes we put our lives in the care of people that are sicker than we are. Anyway, I know I get down and dirty, whatever, it's AA, welcome. You know, if you don't like it, get a resentment in a coffee pot and go down the road. Anyway, so one thing that's really not healthy to do is to make somebody go apologize when 99.999999% was a real hard perpetrator and I am the victim. And now they say, and this is outside of AA, so I'm not going to get way outside of AA, but they say the best thing for somebody to do when they've been victimized is to get sober, to stand on your own two feet, and to write the invisible letter or write the real letter, or maybe with 3, 5, 10, 15 years of sobriety, go on your own and go say, you know, here's how you harmed me, and I have the total inability to form a true partnership, and I'm a terrible wife, and I treated my children poorly. Maybe, but that's a whole different thing, and I'm going to stick with the literature and I'm going to stick with AA, but I don't like asking a sponsee to go apologize to a perpetrator. I think it's a very tricky area, and so that's where we want to use our intuition, and that's where those first three steps come in, where I really learn to have a relationship with God and check myself before I wreck myself. So if I look at the first half of step one, I can see I'm powerless over alcohol, and you can insert anything in there. This is an AA meeting. I don't want to water down the message, but you can put meth or chocolate cake or coke or fentanyl or sex or gambling. It is anything, because the disease wears hats and faces. It wants to be distracted from the present moment. Dash, my life's unmanageable. My life's unmanageable of me, by me, for the rest of my life, unless I try to practice the principles in all of my affairs. I try. I don't do this thing perfectly. Are you kidding me? And I'll get to that in a minute, how imperfectly I've done it, especially this last year. Actually, let's just go into that right now. So anyways, I had 10 years and then I was out for 3. I don't want to do a big drunk log. I have 23 drug and alcohol related cases and 18 prostitution cases, and I lived in the street for 3 years. And so what that basically looks like is, like, you know, drunk in public, you know, possession of a controlled substance, possession of an open container, soliciting with the intent to prostitute, prostitution, soliciting an undercover officer. It just goes on and on. All tons and tons and tons of misdemeanors, lots of them, Twin Towers, you know. And so then that next time that I got sober, somebody handed me these tapes by this guy named Bob Anderson. He started my home group. It's called Prime Time. Again, I'm not the be-all, end-all. I don't have all the answers. My home group's not the answers. There's one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Now means now, and it'll always mean now, and it'll never mean then, and it means now, and then it means now, and then it means now. Which means I have to have a consistent relationship with a power in my life. So I look at the second half of step one. It says, my life is unmanageable. What's unmanageable? It's my thought life that's unmanageable. I hate you and I don't know why. You know, I make my life so small, I really don't even have a whole array of emotions. I just, like, angry, or I'm confused, or something in between, sad, depressed. But even things like grateful or curious or compassion, or, you know, there's all kinds of subtle emotions in between all of that. And my heart mind never got to cultivate those, because I believe I was in fight or flight all the time. I believe I was in survival mode most of my childhood life and most of my adult life. You know, nail biter, insomnia, picking at everything, can't sit still, always looking around, you know, can't follow through with direction. I just don't want to put some severe mental illness label on it. I believe that it's untreated alcoholism. So So powerless over alcohol, dash, my life's unmanageable. My thought life is unmanageable. Not my conscious thoughts, my subconscious thoughts. So I start looking at the thoughts that surf the waves of my brain, and I can see that most of my thoughts are repetitive. They've been there forever, and I've thought them over and over and over, and I think I'm so damn clever, but I'm not. I'm really, really, really not. Most of the thoughts and the ideas and the reactions instead of responses that have been there forever. When I really start to follow the crumb trail back to the witch's house, I can see, like, wow, I remember thinking that forever or feeling that forever. You know, especially stuff like I'm a loser or no one's ever going to love me or I don't ever get picked or this isn't going to go well. You know, all of that stuff. So step two, coming to believe that a power can restore me. It doesn't say coming to believe in a power. It doesn't say in a power, it says that. Coming to believe that a power. Is there a power that could restore me if I turn towards the power? You know, so there's a lot that has to happen internally. It's not just a writing assignment. It's not just homework. It's not just, you know, step four and regurgitating step five and making a list in eight and going out in nine and making amends. And I'm not trying to minimize any steps, but step two and step three and step 11 are very, very, very important. And that I come to believe that a power can restore me, I can only come to believe because I get empirical evidence when I turn towards the power. So I say, like Christine so eloquently says, power, can you protect me from my mind? Can you help me walk into a meeting? I mean, you know, thank God for California. There's so many meetings, but there's people in other parts of the country or other parts of the world where there's only one meeting and they pull up and there's that idiot's car or their old sponsor that they hate and they just leave the whole meeting. They don't even go in, you know? Like, I gotta be able to walk in anywhere and sit down and rightly relate myself to God and not be there for anybody's approval. I'm not here for your approval. I'm here because my life is on the line. I'm here because this is the last house on the block. I'm here because this is a hospital and everybody in here has a gown that's open in the back with tampon strings and testicles hanging down. And if you don't believe me, there's another relapse waiting for us. It's serious. It's very serious business. I came up on 18 years last year and I relapsed and I was in treatment a lot this past year. A lot, a lot, a lot. I don't have any shame in my game on that. Like, I really, really, really want to share that experience because it started out small and some people say they had a drink and they just went right all the way. You know, Bill Wilson says this thing like some guy like, oh, come the carpet slippers, what? Also like some monogram, you know, silk robe, but with women, she turned into a sea hag and was unrecognizable, you know. Anyway, I wasn't either one. Like, I was able to actually control it for a while, for real. I was able to do like two drinks a night, and I was like, when are the wheels going to fall off? Like, when is this? How is this going to go down? And it took months and months and months for it to finally really tip over the edge. But once it tipped over the edge, I'm just blowing up relationships like crazy. I want to kill myself. I love needles. I can't find heroin. Now I'm shooting fentanyl. I got needles. I'm drunk out of my mind. And there I am. And I'm also, I mean, I'm a global speaker. I've spoken all over the world. And now I'm like, how am I going to get this genie back in the bottle? How am I going to get these worms back in the can? You know, what am I going to do? My ego doesn't like this. But if you really want what we have, we got to get humble. And I got to see that this disease is not a moral issue, that it's so deadly. And very few people truly understand. The last people, for the most part, to understand it are our family members. They're usually the first people to slam the door on us because they're just sick of us. They're sick of us. They're sick of our behavior. The longer the relationship, the quicker the trigger. If you and I, whoever you are, we go on a road trip for a week, guarantee we might not get in any fight at all. Put any family member in there that I've had a relationship with for 20 years, somebody's going to go camping in the woods. Two people will go in and one's going to come out. That's it. That's how it's going to go. It's no joke. No joke. So now the wheels are falling off and it's getting bad. It's getting real bad. And I decided to put it on blast because I knew how this was going to go. You know, I've got thousands of Facebook friends. I'm on several AA Facebook. I see he's about to whack me with the 5 minutes. He's about to hit me. Okay, I'm on lots of AA Facebook pages, and I know I'm blowing. I'm putting my own self on blast. So I did. I put my own self on, and I just went for it. I said, "You guys, I am in a relapse, and this is no joke, and I got to go to treatment." And I remember, like, within 48 hours, there was, like, over 600 or 700 people, like, "Oh, my God, I'm praying for you." You know, there was even, like, one clown that's like, "She's been hacked. This can't happen." And I'm thinking, God, people just blow my mind, you know, that they would, I'm dying, and they would think I've been hacked. Anyway, went to the hospital, trying to spin dry, you know, and a treatment center gave me a huge gift. They gave me 4 months free in a really beautiful place, like a $90,000 gift. Mind you, I still relapsed after that again, because this disease is a bitch. It's such a bitch. Anyway, I went into treatment, and it took a long time for me to get settled. I remember every day I would ask myself the same question in treatment. I would say, if I found a bottle of vodka in the laundry room, would I drink some? Every day I said yes, until about 7 weeks into it, I finally said, no, I'm back into AA. Like, I couldn't have done this on my own. There's no way I could have gone home and got sober again. If you're in a sneaky, secret relapse, I understand. It's awful, and it's not going to get better. The chances are very big that it won't. I do believe that relapse is such a big part of recovery that maybe there are lots and lots of people that are terrified to talk about it, because who's going to support them? Me as a global speaker, hundreds of people came to help me. How lucky am I? How freaking lucky am I that people are offering me beds in beautiful places? Not everybody has that opportunity, and I really have such a big heart for people that are in that mode, or that are relapsing, or that are living that secret life. Anyway, I got 2 minutes, and my 2 minutes is all about, I had to build a new relationship with God. I had to get faith all over again. Now that God had to go to the used God lot, and I got to get a whole new one. Power, can you help me? Can you help my prayers not to be dry? Can you help me want what I have? Can you help me be satisfied with my life? Can you help me and my ego take it like a champ when people are like, "Oh my God, we saw this one coming. Her fucking ego is so big. She's speaking all over the place. Finally got what she got." The things that people say, it's absolutely incredible. It's so amazing. So amazing. And I've lost a lot of friends along the way. A lot of people turned on me. You know what? I got to handle the big lumps with the small lumps. And you know what? God makes that possible. An internal relationship with prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with this power. All day long, every day, I can either talk to myself or I can talk to God. And if I'm talking to myself, I'm talking to the disease, and I'm getting what I get. And if I'm in prayer and meditation, I'm using my heart mind. I'm making new neural pathways. I'm backing my disease down. I'm shutting my cake hole. I'm getting right size, and I'm allowing my ego to take a back seat. And that's what this program's all about. Thank you so much for letting me share.